Good evening. This is Mae Brussel. The title of this broadcast is World Watchers. It's program number 752, and it's May the 5th, 1985. This is a one-hour analysis of news, and I suggest that you tape record it when you have a chance. And before I get running along with information and run out of time, I want to tell you that you can write to me, Mae, M-A-E, Brussel, just like it sounds, P.O. Box 225, 11 Carmel, California, 93922, and I will send you a bibliography sheet from this or other broadcasts with the sources of information that I'm citing in case you want to look them up for yourself and have those particular articles or books, the titles that I recommend. Regarding the nuclear plant explosion in the Soviet Union this week, I don't want to spend too much time on it. It's been covered a lot in the media, but I do want to suggest the idea of a possible sabotage. I believed from the way the event took place and the covering of the event that there could be a sabotage against the Soviet Union, and it was selected for this particular time. You remember Reinhard Gehlen, the chief of Hitler's Eastern Intelligence, was given $20 million by Alan Dulles in the 1950s to start literally a war against the Soviet Union to heat up for World War III. And his specialty as Hitler's chief of intelligence was the Eastern Division. Alan Dulles also was working with Edwin Wilson. I'm going into more about Wilson later. But in the 1950s, 1956, Dulles was meeting with Edwin Wilson in Las Vegas, Nevada, and Wilson was to work with security of the U-2 planes that would be over the Soviet Union. But the expertise of Reinhard Gehlen was that he had agents inside the Soviet Union as well as everywhere else in Eastern Europe, and they could be nurturing for occasions such as this. I remember when Marina Oswald met Lee Harvey Oswald, it was through the Alexander Zeiger family, Z-I-G-E-R, and all this information comes from the Warren Commission hearings themselves that were published in 1964, and she was a czarist from a white Russian family. And Mr. Zeiger was from Argentina. And at the time the Warren Commission was doing their work, Isaac Don Levine, who was an agent of the OSS and CIA, had asked the Warren Commission to have the CIA move the daughters of the Zeiger family to Argentina. And this was in 1964, before the Warren Report was even published. I wrote about that in Rebel Magazine in 1983. But the point is that Lee Harvey Oswald worked at the Minsk radio factory, and as I stated before, had been associated at three locations where the U-2 planes were being put together or leaving from those places, and later the U-2 downed the summit, what would be a peace conference between Nikita Khrushchev and President Eisenhower, again sabotage by Alan Dulles, who was working, of course, with Edwin Wilson. And just continue along those lines, about 6 months ago or more, I talked about a book called Out of the Night by Jean Valjean, and this was a great anti-Soviet book. He was an escapee from a Soviet prison, and then it turned out that Valjean was at San Quentin prison and was wanted on a murder charge in California, and when he was released and went to Russia, or Eastern Europe, or just Europe, he came back with a manuscript that Isaac Don Levine helped write, which was a strong Cold War, Hot War. It was a great critique of Soviet prisons, and it turned out to be a prison in California that he had been writing about. Now, many of the Puniman space scientists that came over here on Project Paperclip, the rocket scientists, a good deal of them went to the Soviet Union. They helped put up Sputnik before the United States could get such a feat going. They've had space stations up there for a year, and they have great accomplishments. But how do we know that the SS, the members of the SS, and the Sputnik Project Paperclip scientists that came to this country and the other split with Russia do not have their allegiance, which was the oath of the SS, to a Fourth Reich, to a thousand-year Reich? And do you really believe that all of Hitler's Nazis that worked at Puniman and Dora that split with the ones that came to America for the race to Star Wars and so forth, do you really think in their minds that they favor the Soviet Union? Or, again, like the serpent's egg, have they been nurtured to do not only what they did now, possibly, but to do more harm? Now, the fifth point about this is that the Soviet Union has been pleading with space talks, with talks about Star Wars, with summit meetings based upon the fact of shelving Star Wars, where Ronald Reagan and Edward Teller and Secretary of Navy John Lehman know that Star Wars is a first-strike capability. And Lehman talked on the Ted Koppel show about how to start World War III in the North Sea, attack the Soviet Union. We're talking war, we're talking attack, we're using Star Wars, and the Soviets want to stop the Star War project. And as soon as the nuclear explosion took place in Russia, Bonn, Germany officials were telling them, now you stop your nuclear activity. At a time where we are contracting and giving out money, so much money that when Reagan's out of office, it won't matter who's president, and start rolling the Star Wars contracts as if they haven't been doing it for 40 years, move it along so it's acceptable by people around the world, but tell Russia, you're careless, you can't have that capability. Now, the United States has gone economically broke. It has doubled its debt in 5 years since Ronald Reagan was president, but for 40 years, we have built up this $2 trillion debt. And at a time when the summit is coming, it's an economic summit, an annual one in Japan of seven major nations, the United States is literally bankrupt, can hardly pay the interest on its debts, illegally borrowed from Social Security funds last year in order for Ronald and Nancy to make the trip to Europe. And so now that there's an economic summit coming, Reagan and the powers that be at the Pentagon are the greatest diversionaries from the real issues. And what will be the issues at the summit? They'll talk about terrorism and they'll talk about the Russian nuclear plant because they seem like the overriding issues and take a lot of space away from the real hard facts of the economy. The real hard facts of the economy are the trade problems, and also the stock market dropped 41% this week, and that's just the beginning of what's going to happen. To the economy, it's going to get worse. So while the Soviet nuclear plant blows up, we tell the Russians, Germany says, don't make a nuclear plant, stop, in effect, making plutonium, stop your nuclear activities, you're a menace and a danger. And just of April 1986, Germany signed their deal with us with the Star Wars. Israel was the first country to sign in Japan. So the old Nazi axis only, this time it is Germany, America, and Japan together contracting Star Wars, and the plant in Russia just conveniently catches fire at a time preceding the summit. Now, who in Russia, is asking the United States to help them with the fire? I read that they asked for help from Germany. Are those the old Punamunda scientists? I can't believe that the KGB and the Russian intelligence and the Russian military and the expertise on space can't put out a fire or don't have contingencies for fire in the event it's going to take place. They are great scientists with this kind of thing, and I don't know why they would let their guard down to ask the Germans to come in unless the invitation to come help us put out the fire from United States and from Germany are the German scientists, the equivalent of the ones at Muscle Shoals, Alabama, the rocket scientists that gave the orders to go up to let the shuttle go, even though the Challenger would probably, most probably, disintegrate, particularly in that coldest day ever. So who in Russia is saying, help us, and inviting into Russia under the guise of scientists, were they invited by the other Punamundora people? You have to ask the question because of the timing and the circumstances of the way this is taking place. Another reason I'm so suspicious of this event happening now is the way the news media pounced on it. They didn't treat it as a tragedy that would affect all of us. They treated us as if this old enemy, the media from the TV, the articles, the editorials, were identical to when the Korean airline went down. Now, we were told last week that Mr. Wick of the CIA, U.S. Information Agency, and the American radio propaganda media were told in advance of the bombing of Libya, so immediately after the airplanes left, they could tell the Libyan people how bad Gaddafi was, America loves them, but that they have to get rid of Gaddafi and everything will be fine. Now, this same kind of synchronized editorials and TV and radio talk shows, I just can't believe that people would come in on a tragedy. It didn't happen with Bhopal, it didn't happen when the Challenger blew up. And remember when the Challenger blew up, the evidence came out that the next shuttle to go up would have plutonium, this deadly plutonium that I talked about, and nobody was worried about our real irresponsibility or the secret that they knew that these rocket boosters might fail and could fail and should because they were taking money from their safety and putting it away, billions, so that they could put in a side drawer for the Star Wars later. And the plutonium could be spilled on specific countries. They wouldn't name which ones, but hinted it. It could be used as a weapon. It could be as an excuse for emergency police dictatorship that Reagan has built up, that I cited before, the Federal Emergency Management and so forth. But the way the media handled it and the timing made me very suspicious, because the economic summit is a very serious thing, and we are probably in worse shape than any of the seven countries going to the economic summit. And Ronald Reagan is personally responsible for the disaster that is happening. And he knew that this book would come out of David Stockman's, that we don't know beans about money. And this country is not run by people who are logical or skilled at the problems. And so what better way to pull out some of Galen's agents or Hitler's past agents and decide this is a time to put Russia behind and make them look like they are polluting the world. The Los Angeles Times had a story this week by Jack Nelson. Reagan ready to head for Tokyo. Schultz shows irritation on Asian policy issues. And just briefly, it tells about the president's trip that was jarred by continuous economic and political differences in Asia with the non-aligned countries, and discussions went to terrorism and the Soviets' nuclear disaster, which is likely to dominate the agenda of the 12th Economic Summit. Well, maybe that's what they want, that the nuclear takeover, the terrorism, which George Shultz has pinpointed to the Soviet Union as being responsible for all terrorism, and now this nuclear explosion will dominate the agenda, and Reagan, who can't do anything but read little cards anyway, will pass the buck and they'll get off on these other subjects that all point to the Soviet Union. The news of the nuclear disaster, according to Jack Nelson, the Times, and the administration's attempt to respond to it without adequate information overshadowed Reagan's three-day visit so far, and there's a shadow over Tokyo when seven major industrial democracies meet. And then the article goes on the eve of Reagan's departure from Bali for Tokyo, George Shultz was exasperated. He was fenced with reporters over Southeast Asian policy differences. He's irritated with their policies, not ours, and he's expressed irritation at the Soviets for failing to provide more information about Chernobyl nuclear power plant. Now, we provided no information on the John Kennedy assassination, Robert Kennedy, Martin Luther King. True, Three Mile Island didn't explode, but we have had no information about nuclear waste that Ronald Reagan stopped from being cleaned up for political reasons, so it wouldn't appear that Jerry Brown and other Democrats had a successful cleanup during their administration. We have had more deaths from nuclear pollution in this country, but we keep throwing this anger to the Soviet Union, so it's a good way to let this summit, the meeting in Tokyo, be about terrorism and the Russians and the nuclear explosion. And for all purposes, the fire is out, and if you save the articles for the past 7 days, you know, it could have been very dangerous and quite a few people were affected, but not as many people affected as by other things right in our environment here, which you don't know about, which you are eating, which they are selling to you and poisoning you. And that is the way we attack Russia and not look at ourselves. Many articles, as I say, secrecy shrouds the extent of the loss. Mary McGrory wrote, Mikhail Gorbachev's image and meltdown, and they are tearing him apart, and they get in on the act. The so-called liberal writers, forget the fascists like William Buckley and the others, but the liberals like Mary McGrory, they want to come in and attack the Soviet Union. Well, we had an example of the so-called liberals attacking Libya and Gaddafi several weeks ago. They all got on the bandwagon. One of them got off the bandwagon this week. This was Richard Goodwin. I don't know if you saw his article. It was reprinted in the LA Times. And it's very significant how the so-called left or liberal or the thinking or the caring people are totally ignoring statistics and facts and getting in this groundswell of Ronald Reagan, Goebbels' propaganda instead of separating these events from their own minds. And Richard Goodwin wrote an article this week titled, "Fervor Gives Way to Reason on Libya. The Raid Was Wrong." Now, he is apologizing for what you wrote several weeks ago. William Buckley, several years later, apologized for defending the Greek military, not the Greek, the Argentine military junta and the death squads, and apologized for getting in on that fervor of defending Argentina. I just want to cite a few sentences of Richard Goodwin because they're so important. He said, writing for this page, just after we bombed Libya, I expressed some justification for the raid. And I was really shocked that he did it at the time. He said, I was mistaken. I was caught up by patriotic righteousness of the moment. We finally showed the bastards, in quotes. I did not pause for the imaginative reflection that now persuades me that the raid was a serious error in moral terms and in foreign policy. In the days that followed the raid, there were two immediate stimuli to reconsideration. First, there was the awareness that Libyan civilians were injured, made homeless. There was this horror from the skies. The people were not terrorists. They didn't choose their leader necessarily any more than West Germany, those people that dropped the bomb on the discotheque, knew or were familiar with the policies of Libya, and they were doing something that was unfamiliar to them, but they did it. It was wrong. And he said the only offense of the people being born in was being born in Libya, and their vulnerability was being poor citizens of a weak third world country. The second source of second sight was the obscene spectacle of an American president grinning in triumph as he boasted that we had shown that we meant business and ebulliently threatened to do it again, this time Iran and Syria. And remember that face at Grenada and how he went back for the victory celebration. The face and Caspar Weinberger always pointing to his charts and maps to justify what he was doing. And Richard Goodwin says, a wise man does not exult in his power to destroy. It is not bravery to order a handful of American pilots against a small and relatively defenseless country from the comfortable security of a fortified continent. It is an abdication of leadership to arouse and misdirect the frustrated anger of Americans by equating it with an act of revenge, with a purposeful expression of national will. In a violent world, we must occasionally act with violence, but it is nothing to brag about. And when the act is without risk to those who command it, there is no courage. It is not strength, but weakness that speaks the unwillingness to face up to the harsh realities. He says, Americans find it difficult to accept that there are problems in this world with no quick solution, that there is danger in our power and wealth, and we have to be careful. And he apologized. He said, America once seemed to promise so much. Our abdication has aroused intense hostilities. It may not seem fair, but nations like people are judged by their pretensions. And we pronounced ourselves ally to the wretched of the earth, having abandoned that alliance, one that was wise and moral and just, we are inflicting on our own future a wound far more serious than the feeble blows on terrorists. He apologized then, and I believe if you give time to the stories of that nuclear reactor, and if they investigate it properly, they will find that all this coming down on Russia for polluting the earth and endangering the lives of people and children is something that could have happened to us and could have been triggered at this particular moment. The Challenger's out of the news. Libya's out of the news. This week, it is the nuclear reactor in the Soviet Union, and next week, it will be something else. One quick item about Mr. Waldheim that was in the newspapers, the New York Times this week, May the 2nd. They found a book in which he wrote about the killings and the ordering of people to be murdered. As a first lieutenant in the Army's group, he kept a book. And the interesting thing about the book, written by Waldheim, July 19th to August 21st, 1923, he was assigned to the German General Staff Liaison, attached to the Italian 11th Army in northwest Greece. And there's an index in the book that bears his name. and these and other German war documents were found in the National Archives in Washington, D.C. They've been there, and the documents have been available for public domain since the mid-60s, and it was only when it came to light that he was going to be president of Austria that the former UN chief had served in the Balkans, and then a Robert Herzstein, H-E-R-Z-S-T-E-I-N, professor at the University of South Carolina, found these documents about the atrocities, that Waldheim knew them, that he wrote about them, that he said, according to the orders of the Führer, the bandits must be captured, and bandits, of course, were partisans, people defending Greece when Hitler invaded Greece. They had to be shot, taken and shot, and others were deported to labor details in Germany, which was death, thousands and thousands of deaths. The point is that the information was available all this time, and nobody sought to look for it. And the second point, of course, is that the Greece activities, his Greek activities, and working with the Wehrmacht are documented. And I said at the time that Olaf Palme was murdered, that he and Lady Fleming from Greece, who died the same week, would be very familiar with the Greek activities as well as other people. Now, if this is available, where is the documentation on Fritz Kramer, Mr. Fritz Kramer, who came here from Germany, who went to the Battle of the Bulge, who put Henry Kissinger at Harvard, who put Kissinger in charge of Klaus Barbie and Otto Skorzeny and the top Nazis that would be released by the new Senator Joe McCarthy? And also, where are the documents on Joseph Mengele and his genetic experiments? I'll do more, hopefully, next week on that and the implications of the Mengele story and the Fritz Kramer story and how it's affecting us every day. Now, I didn't get a chance to mention it, but April 18th, 2 weeks ago, Pete Carey won the Pulitzer Prize. He writes for the San Jose Mercury. He won it with two other authors who were working with him, Lewis Simmons and a Catherine Ellison. And Pete won the prize for international reporting that they did last summer on the investigation of Marcos and the flight capital, the money from the Philippines that had been going for the past 20 years out of the country. Now, I gave Pete Carey the Pulitzer Prize several years ago. This is one of these crazy things, but when I read about Frank Turple working in California at Stanford Technology, and many of you remember the story, and I called Pete to congratulate him, and I talked to him all the time and laughed about it. I said, look, if Frank Turple, the notorious Turple, was at Stanford Technology, you have a story here. You can get a Pulitzer Prize. Well, he came down to the house, and the rest is history. I've mentioned it to you many times. David Emery has talked about Pete Carey on KFJC and the relationship to Otto von Bolschwing. But it was when I called Pete, and he came to the house and got about six books, and then Nazi Germany, then more, then went into the archives of the newspapers and came out and discovered the notorious Otto von Bolschwing, who was linked to Stanford Technology. And he did a brilliant article, but it was so far ahead of its time. We had so many men and people involved, and women like Helene von Dahm involved in this story, that the powers that be at San Jose Mercury didn't give him a series. If he had followed it straight through and done three or four articles, I'm positive that he would have won a Pulitzer Prize at the time. But anyway, he won it now and on the Philippines, and that is a really great thing for him to do, along with the other people that he worked with. Just as Robert Herzstein from the University of South Carolina was able to pull out the material on Mr. Waldheim, Kurt Waldheim, research is very important, and this is why I'm emphasizing this to you, because through this research that I'm doing, just as he did with his information in the archives and knew what to look for about Waldheim, I could get to Pete, and we could put together information that, if it hasn't been used properly yet, is invaluable and will be put together if people want to trace and retrace the corporations that Frank Turple and Otto von Bolschwing were connected with that are affecting our lives today. Now, I mentioned the new book about Edwin Wilson last week. It's called Manhunt, The Incredible Pursuit of a CIA Agent Turned Terrorist by Peter Moss, Random House, 1986. And there are two pages that references to Stanford Technology that are very important. One, Chapter 7, How Edwin Wilson Met Frank Turple in 1975 at a Christmas Party. Frank Turbel's office, and Turbel worked for the CIA, was a few blocks away from Edwin Wilson's office, and Wilson had worked for the CIA from 1956 on. Turbel told Wilson he had a really good hook on Gaddafi's first cousin, who handled military procurement, and there were millions to be made. Wilson's office in Washington was a CIA front called Consultants International. Frank Turbel was working for the CIA selling surveillance devices and had a sales company in California called Intercontinental Technology that was the subsidiary of Stanford Technology. Wilson was impressed with Stanford Technology in the heart of Silicon Valley. It was run by Albert Hakim, H-A-K-I-M, an Iranian citizen who supplied surveillance for the Shah of Iran's secret police, the Savak. Now, the Savak is identical to Kurt Waldheim's killing the resistance fighters. The Savak is to kill anybody who opposes the regime that was put in by Henry Kissinger and Alan Dulles, the Iranian Shah of Iran, the Pahlavi family with close ties to Nazi Germany. And so continuing from Kurt Waldheim's work in Greece, delivering to the concentration camps and killing the resistance, and Klaus Barbie was under the protection of Henry Kissinger, and he was killing the resistance people in France and in Europe until he went to South America. Now, page 287 of Manhunt says, Theodore Shackley was retained as a consultant for Stanford Technology after Edwin Wilson left there and continued working with Albert Hakim, the Iranian, and sending material. And, of course, Richard Helms, the former director of the CIA, was over there. And I'll do more and have done a lot on Theodore Shackley, a very, very important man for covert action, private armies, and literally the death squad team, the covert action. So just this new book mentioned Stanford Technology twice, and as soon as I read that Frank Turbel was linked to that, this is when I knew I had that big story. And let me just summarize this again because it's very important. Edwin Wilson latched on and got associated with Frank Turbel, and because of his links to Stanford Technology, but Edwin Wilson was high up in the CIA, right with Alan Dulles right from the very beginning. And the interest in common was Stanford Technology. Stanford Technology was a corporation linked into a dummy front put together by Otto von Bolschwing, Adolf Eichmann's superior. He was living in California, in Sacramento, in Silicon Valley, and his secretary, one of the people who invested in his company, was Helene von Thom, and she was an interpreter speaking German and translating it while she was the secretary for 8 years to Governor Ronald Reagan. When Reagan went to Washington, Helene von Thom went with him, helped make appointments for the first and second administration, went on to be ambassador to Austria, and is in the company of Kurt Waldheim, the new president of Austria. Edwin Wilson was arrested. He was brought to this country in June 1982 by a man he worked with and knew, Ernest Kaiser, and trusted him. The new book doesn't talk about Ernest von Kaiser having been in the Wehrmacht, but he was accompanied by Kaiser to Dominican Republic and then was arrested and taken to the United States. After Wilson was home and tucked into jail, Mr. Kaiser fled the country in February 1985 and was in Bonn, Germany with Rafi Eitan of the Mossad that I've talked about many times and will do much, much more later on Eitan. And they knew that at that time that Mengele was alive in February 85, and it was that knowledge of theirs plus the scrambling of intelligence operatives after the drug trial cases where various people mentioned having been with Joseph Mengele in drug traffic in South America that caused the Mengele case to be closed as quickly as possible. And I'm going to update for you the Mengele story as soon as I can. Joseph Mengele left Europe with the help of the United States Army. He had worked with the CIA. He went to Argentina. He took his medical records with him. He left Auschwitz in 1945. To do future genetic work. He practiced medicine in Argentina, and he went down there in 1952 with other top Nazis, several of them described in the recent covert action, and I'll reread that. I shared some of that a while back. And go back. The important thing is that the connections through history, through the years, put these various characters all together as a network. I'm going to do the second half of this broadcast. We'll take a one-minute break and then go on to advanced genetic sciences and update that information with you as much as time allows for this week and continue it probably the next week.